The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and it's my honor to be here to introduce tonight's guests. But before I do, I would just like to take a very brief moment to thank all of you at home. This is the first talk of our spring, isn't it spring like outside, spring 2021 author series. And in more ways than one, you all continue to make our author events possible through your viewership and listenership, through your enthusiastic and encouraging messages to us, and yes, also through your kind donations. So on behalf of the Free Library and our little crew here in the Author Events Office, again, many thanks. On to the show. I think most of you are probably very familiar with George Saunders because I've noticed that he doesn't tend to have casual fans. But for those of you who aren't familiar and have tuned in because of the recommendation of a teacher, partner, or as was my case some 13 or so years ago, by a friend who is haranguing you to read George Saunders, to you people, welcome. And be warned, after reading his work, you'll be the person demanding that your friends, partners, etc., read this author's books. Referred to by the New York Times Book Review as one of the most gifted, wickedly entertaining story writers around, George Saunders won the Man Booker Prize for Lincoln and the Bardo, a kaleidoscopic tale of the 16th president's son's death and purgatorial afterlife. You just have to read it to understand. His surreal short story collections include the New York Times notable books Pastoralia, 10th of December, and one of my all-time favorites, Civil War Land and Bad Decline. A professor of creative writing at Syracuse University, Mr. Saunders is the recipient of Guggenheim and MacArthur Fellowships and has been honored by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He is here tonight with A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. Pairing iconic short stories by Chekhov, Turgenev, Tolstoy, and Gogol with seven corresponding essays. Don't blow me up because of my Russian pronunciation too. It is a meditative masterclass on what it makes to make great fiction click. A review in The Guardian states, this book is a delight, and it's about delight too. How necessary at our particular moment. And it claims that one of the pleasures of this book is feeling his own thinking move backwards and forwards between the writer dissecting practice and the reader entering in through the spell of the words to dwell inside the story. Tonight, Mr. Saunders will be in conversation with Daniel Tordai, director of the creative writing program at Bryn Mawr College. Mr. Tordai is the author of The Last Flight of Poxa West, Boomer One, and The Sensualist. He is a two-time winner of the National Jewish Book Award, a two-time author events guest, a good friend of the Free Library, and an even better friend of tonight's author. Gentlemen, thank you for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Well, thank you, Jason. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, George, for being here. I know you wanted to make a couple of preambulatory comments, so I'll get out your way.
Yeah. The first thing I want to do is just wish everybody a happy Martin Luther King Day, and you know, just take a second to remember that beautiful man and whose beautiful message was so perfect years ago, and it's still relevant. And just be happy that he was among us. The second thing is just to say that you might notice I've got a technological issue. I'm in Oneonta, New York, up in the woods, on satellite internet. So there's going to be a delay in the audio, or the video rather. The audio is usually pretty solid, so I'm going to try to be extra smart in what I say to kind of make up for how I look, which is kind of the story of my life. And so, all that. Just thank you, Dan, so much for being here. What a pleasure.
It is so good to see you, George. And it'll be good for us to have some pause in between speaking. I actually wanted to just, before even asking you a question, to say I was one of those small group of folks who was lucky enough to upend what was a pretty decent life to move up to beautiful Syria to study with you and with Arthur Flowers and with Mary Carr and all the amazing writers up there, and it'd be hard to overstate the influence you've had on my life. So I will I'll either cry or gush at some point here. but to bring us up to speed, I actually just was going to start by saying the last time we saw each other was, I guess, now a little more than 2 years ago when you were at the Free Library to do that really cool performance of Lincoln and the Bardo, which since has become a number one New York Times bestseller and won the Booker Prize. So I'd actually love to just hear, clearly like a year of that is COVID, but just I bet we'd all love to hear a little bit about what your life has been like from, because I think that was the first event for Lincoln and the Bardo, right? Or one of the first.
Yeah, I think it was. It was. Yeah. Well, I mean, we were out in California when COVID hit, and we were kind of hunkered down there in Santa Cruz, and then the fire started. And so we were kind of waiting for the swarm of locusts. And so we headed to New York, and we've been up here ever since. And I think we're going to spend the winter. And really, you know, it's been, I mean, our goal was to kind of just, because we can, to stay home as much as we could and kind of try to do the right thing in that way. So we've done that. And, you know, just, I guess, kind of like feeling the sorrow seeping in from every direction, you know, since the COVID and the racist murders and then the near insurrection. It's kind of amazing, you know, but I feel like part of the thing is just, you know, we each have to, well, we each don't, I feel like I have to keep my spirits up so that if something is needed of me, I'll be whole. So I've been trying to work hard and trying to just, you know, keep things a little bit sane and not do any more despairing than necessary. How have you been doing?
I've been okay. I feel like I mask a lot of concern with anger in a way that is like not something that's totally natural to me. But I was actually just thinking, and we'll come back around to this maybe after we talk about the Russians book for a little while, but I actually remember we sat down for a drink after that Lincoln and the Bardo reading, and I guess it was just after the 2016 election, and I remember turning to you and saying, like, so what's going to come next? You had just published that New Yorker piece about the Trump rallies you've been to, and I remember it was really the first time I'd ever heard this response out of you, but I remember you just saying, I have no idea. I mean, I remember just getting that sense of, yeah. I was just like, there's no one I can talk to right now who feels like they're prepared to see around a corner. Yeah. So let me...
You know, it's a funny thing when you... I was just going to say, you know, it's funny when you're doing a lot of public talking, you know, that you're conditioned to answer any question, you know, and after that, the set of rallies, I just like, you know, the most intellectually honest thing and maybe the hardest thing to do is just go, I just don't have enough information and we're in kind of uncharted territory. And I think actually we still, you know, we still are. It's
well, we're certainly on a bookend of it. Yeah. So okay, I want to make sure that we give a lot of time over to this book that I know that the folks here are thinking about. So there's this amazing book which I actually just finished reading today, in which you take on, as Jason said, Turgenev and Chekhov a couple of times, Tolstoy a couple of times, and Gogol. But it also, I mean, it really frames a sense of your now legendary teaching, you know, and for folks like me, when I came up to Syracuse, it was because I you know, I knew I loved your work and I'd talked to you enough times to know how much I wanted to be around you as a person, but it really was something special to see the way you teach. So my very serious first question for you is, will this book put all MFA programs out of business forever?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the nice thing about the book is that, you know, when we had this Russian class, the trick for me was always, well, it was easy actually, because the students there, we get like 700 applications a year in fiction and we pick six people. So with a room of 20 of those people, you don't have to do much. And you can sort of lead the horse to the water by pointing out a certain passage in Tolstoy and asking a leading question. And then off you go. Here, you know, you have to kind of be the horse and be the water and complete the thought, which was tricky. But I think the missing component obviously is, and probably the most valuable thing is, when you're in a particular room with a particular student talking about a particular story of hers, doing line edits. And the second part is that place where you kind of, over the 3 years, you get to know a person's psychology kind of, and then you can kind of feel when there might be a right moment to say something or to inflect them. It's almost like judo, you know, you're using their energy and maybe your temporary illusory authority to deflect them slightly up to the higher ground. And that's really fun work. And of course the book can't really do that. But the one thing that I think is in there is the quality of those classes up there in Hall of Languages, whatever it was, 401 or something, which, you know, my goal was always prepare, go in with a pretty bold throwdown and know that there was going to be disagreement and there was going to be tumult and there was going to be back and forth. And I guess the idea is if you can get that going among students that brilliant, little rays of light are going to hit each person depending on their needs, you know, but the main thing is to get something going, give them something to push against. So in the book, you know, I present the full text of the Russian story, and then I, you know, hopefully persuasively tell how I read it. But then the next step for the reader is to go, well, yes and no, you know, I agree, I don't agree. And then we get a little, you know, a little back and forth going.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I think, and none of these will be spoilers for this wonderful audience who's going to be picking the book up, but, you know, for the sake of our conversation, and actually, let me just pause myself to say, I'm starting to see some questions coming through. So for the audience, George and I will probably talk for 20 or 30 minutes, and then I'll be sure to turn around to get you guys in on those conversations, and I'll bring those questions in as we go, so keep them coming. But I was just going to mention, I mean, I think there's like a real genius to the book in the way that you go from, you know, we get some Chekhov and we get some Tolstoy. And then when you turn to Gogol, there is that sense of like, okay, so the person who's ready to talk about a guy whose nose appears in a loaf of bread, okay, now we can like make that explosion. And I wonder, you know, when you and your editor, Andy Ward at Random House, were putting this together, like how much were you thinking about how that reading experience would be the order in which we got the stories?
The way it worked for me was that I had, you know, in the class we would do about 40 stories. Well, that's impossible if you want to have the text. So I whittled it down to about 12. That was still too much. So then it was like, all right, there has to be 7 stories and they have to be ordered in such a way that minimizes my repetition. You know, I want to say something once and then be able to pick it up throughout the course of the book. So it was a kind of a Rubik's Cube thing, you know, which stories you put in, how long can my essays be, and what order do they go in? The Gogol for me was the hardest. I think that's probably the least, it's the least nailed down of those essays, because that guy is so fucking good that, and weird, that it's very hard to, my usual method was, which is somewhat logical, kind of hits a bump when I get to him, you know, but I thought it would be good to kind of throw the curveball in at that point, if nothing else, to remind myself that these stories can't really be reduced as neatly as I sometimes want to reduce them. You know, there's always got to be an element of mystery, and like, yeah, it's, you know, if you could reduce it mathematically, it'd be a lot easier to do, you know.
Well, and it's so interesting how
that's a great story, and he's a great.
Oh God, I was going to say it's so interesting how like Master and Man and the Darling are stories that do that like so mechanically, but then when you jump into Gogol, all of a sudden it's just like an explosion. So hey, so we have a bunch of really good questions here, so I'm going to jump into a couple of them. So a wonderful person named Paul Pastor, and I'm going to read this straightforwardly because I think it's really wonderful how he asks it. He says, "Hi George. In many ways, it feels like America today is struggling with the loss of a common national story. What can we do today with the spirit of these 4 dead Russians in mind to recover a compelling and true common story?"
Wow, it is a great question. I guess my answer would be yeah, 100%. I agree with that question. I think, all right, here's what I went through with this book. You know, I was writing it during the Trump era, then all the racist murders happened, and then there was COVID, and I'm up there working on Tolstoy, kind of like, what, you know, what am I doing? But I think that what I took from it was that, you know, literature is a scale model of what we do in every moment. Like when we think about another person, we're writing a novel about them, and we're doing it on the flimsiest of data, these little quick projections that we get. So literature kind of trains us that, one, we're good at improving our projections. You know, we can start off with a facile, negative, oppositional projection, and we can actually revise our projections into something that's more three-dimensional and compassionate. That, I think, is something that is hanging over us as a country. And this is a little bit too easy, but I can't help but make a connection between the rise of social media, which is sort of anti-fiction. You know, it's quick, it's agenda-laced, it's pretty superficial, it's fun, but it isn't deep. You don't revise it. So I think there are lessons to be learned. The one thing I kept thinking with this book was something like this. If you took a baseball stadium full of people, and you put, you know, right wingers and left wingers in the stadium, you got somebody up there to start talking as in as agitated a way as possible about immigration and whatever, you know, you'd have fights breaking out. Of course you would. If you took that guy out and you had the Yankees and the Red Sox run out, suddenly there's a shift in the polarity. There are different allegiances show, and there might still be some anger or some back and forth, but it's in a different tone and it's a little more genial. So I think the one thing we are going to have to do is somehow shift the polarity of these dominant conversations, many of which are being imposed on us by outside agencies anyway, you know, for profit agencies. And I think somehow for me, that's a literary message, you know, to say we actually, by concentrating on one human mind and a story, we can get more confident of our ability to engage with other people. And, you know, I think you have to be, as I say in the book, you have to be a little careful about making huge claims for fiction. But I would guess that you could track the dysfunction in our country approximately to eroded modes of storytelling, which is a whole different topic, but, you know.
Yeah, but I think,
so, in other words, Paul, I have no idea.
I think it's right up the middle of the question that Paul asked in of this book. And it's a thing I've thought about, which is that, you know, I've taught the Brain Dead Megaphone a number of times recently, and I've taught the essay, and I've taught the Brief and Frightening Arena Phil. And I think I've told you over email, I've had students who have said, so is he a prophet or a writer? and I do, when I think about the one moment where you're willing to get kind of prescriptive at the end of Brain Dead Megaphone, and you do say, you know, I think our job is just to be as precise and as specific as possible as writers, thinkers, and speakers. And I wonder, you know, a decade and a half on, does that still feel like a sufficient answer to you?
Well, you know, when David Wallace read that essay, he liked it, except he said, you kind of chickened out at the end a little bit. And I said, I didn't really chicken out. I just think that's true. He goes, yeah, but it's basically that's a solution that's quite small compared to the enormity of the problem. And I think that's actually true. I think we're seeing it now. So I don't know, you know, I think, again, I have a bit of a bunker mentality in that I think in a situation as crazy as we're in now, my instinct is to say, okay, let's make sure that me, George, is somehow, you know, practicing the best qualities I can get to. You know, let me make sure that I don't, you know, drink from the poison well if I can help it. And for me, a kind of contemplative relation to fiction is somehow really helpful, you know, just to say, well, other minds operate basically like mine. The other lesson from fiction, I think, is that we can actually defer judgment much longer than we think, you know, especially in Chekhov. You see that he's really reluctant to pronounce judgment. It's like a ritual practice with him to keep saying, on the other hand, I think that's a pretty good thing, you know, to say someday I have to decide and some days I have to act, but most days I don't. So we can kind of keep our minds open longer than we think, which in turn lets more data come in. Which prepares us to act more intelligently when we get to, I guess. I don't know. You know, for me, it's mostly just that to be honest, a day when I work, even if it doesn't go well, I come out of it better equipped, you know, to deal with the rest of the day, you know. So,
yeah, I thought a lot of it in the Gooseberries section, and you kind of get there, but there's so many times in his letters where he's attacked about not coming down hard enough on a with his opinions, and he says it's not my job to have an opinion about optimism, about horse stealing. It's just my job to show how people spoke and thought as clearly as possible. And I think actually it's a nice segue to a really wonderful question here from Patricia McKinney, who says, first, thank you for being here, beloved George Saunders. You represent the very best of us as an American.
Beloved Patricia McKinney.
And then she asks, before there were MFA programs and writers' workshops, there were fully formed masterpieces as here in your book. If these stories arrived on your desk as is, would you have suggested changes according to the modern methods that you have adopted as a teacher?
It's a trick question in a way, Patricia, because I think the answer would be no. But of course, my whole aesthetic has been prepared by these very stories. So it's kind of tricky. I think creative writing programs are healthy in and maybe healthier now than they were 20 years ago, in the sense that when something good comes across, the room rises to the occasion. I saw this semester. We had a couple of really wonderful stories about which there wasn't much to be said. And to the workshop's credit, it just said, good job, you know? So I'm pretty confident that they would be there. They work differently. One of the weird things about this book was I'd been teaching these for 20 something years, and to go in and read them this closely, they're even better than I thought. I was missing a lot in the class. I think I'd give Chekhov an A.
No, they're actually, I'd point out, and I don't want to spoil anything in the book, but they're, you have these nice little kind of postscripts in each of the sections where we hear about a moment in Tolstoy's Master and Man that maybe you wish would have gone differently and you would have been able to talk to him about it. And I think it's kind of implicit in the Turgenev that they're, it's both beautiful, but it's beautiful with warts, right?
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, one of the things I learned in the class was that the best teaching stories aren't always the masterpieces. Because those, everybody just throws up their hands and go, yeah, okay. But the Turgenev is a little flawed. And that's a great moment in the class. It usually comes about maybe 3 or 4 weeks in. We're kind of getting our legs under us. And I give them that story. And it's really slow, you know, and it's really long-winded and it's really old-fashioned. And so you come in that day and you can see everybody's a little bit on edge, like, oh, God, you know, he likes this one. And then eventually somebody will say it, you know, this irritated me so much. And that's when you know you're kind of off to the races, because I think of it sort of as story morgue. You know, the stories are there. Everybody involved in them is dead. You can look at it pretty objectively and dreamily, you know, and kind of say, well, he could have done this differently. And that's a really healthy thing to do, you know, to look at a story and love it. And at the same time, diagnostically kind of be willing to poke at it a little bit, just for the benefit of your own work, because that's really why we're there. You know, we're not there to give the award for best story. We're there to try to get those talented young people to do, you know, what only they can do.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I learned a ton from you about being a teacher. And I knew that I wanted to teach if I could. And I've seen you teaching in a lot of different situations, including, you know, being with you now. But I wonder, when you think about like where you were when you started out being a teacher, were there qualities that like you kind of knew in your temperament that you knew would make you want to teach, or how did you sort of come around to that in your life?
Well, I'd had some great teachers as a young person. I had an English teacher in high school named Sherry Williams, who was magnificent. She just was such a caring, nurturing teacher. And then I had, of course, Toby Wolf and Doug Unger. But I think honestly, you know, I mean, at that time, the idea was you get a teaching job so you can write. And, you know, you teach, but you don't really, you know, I mean, you take it seriously. But then the first time I walked in the class and met that first group, your heart goes out to them and you're like, I cannot let these people down. And oh, shit, I don't know that I have anything to offer them, actually. You know, they're so smart. And I was just kind of getting my legs under me as a writer too. So then it became kind of a, you know, a career long struggle to always take it to always treat it reverently, actually, you know, to say these young people have, you know, given me, they've passed over law school for this, you know, or in your case, you've quit a good writing job to be here. So you owe them something. Now, even having said that, it's not guaranteed you could help everybody. You know, there's some people that you can't. And so I found it really beautiful. And as I say in the book, it's really at this stage of life, you look back and you think, yeah, my work, you know, I don't know, it'll probably be gone in, you know, shortly after I am. But the moments of true interaction with young people who maybe you positively inflected, that's gold, you know. So I think the thing I learned that was so wonderful is that for me anyway, it's not true for everybody, but for me, the teaching life and the writing life were completely connected. There was no contradiction at all. They fed one another. You know, Dan, I wanted to ask you something though. One of the questions I get all the time on email is young people asking if they should get an MFA, or people who have been out, as you had been out in the world for a while. Do you have a sense? I guess what I want to ask you is, in retrospect, what was the benefit of the MFA? And as a second part, if you were designing an MFA program from scratch, what kind of things would you build into it with 2020 hindsight?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. it probably takes more thought than I have now, but I would say, you know, when I talk to my students now, the criteria that I always just throw out there first are, you know, I think you want to go study with a writer who you respect and you think is going to get the work that you want to do. And I think it really matters not to pay for it. And in fact, one of the big things I see now, and I'm not sure how much attention you probably even have to pay to it anymore, but you know, I think it's really aligned that the schools like Syracuse that are able to offer people fellowships have sort of gotten into the space of those are the schools people want to go to. So I think not going into debt. And then the biggest thing, and I can't remember if you and I talked about this now 15 years ago when I was thinking about it, but was just to look at a school on paper and get a sense if it respects the way that writing actually gets done, which is a ton of time to read, a ton of time to write. And that kind of being it, right? I mean, almost treating it like the Medici's are going to give you this fellowship to go do this work. And I think, you know, it takes away a kind of competition that actually isn't true of the publishing world, right? I mean, I think one thing you and I have probably both seen is that as hard as publishing is, if Random House thought they could publish a book by everyone on this chat right now, they'd publish them all, right? If they knew that they could earn those advances back. It's actually not a zero-sum game. So if there's a program that treats it as a zero-sum game, it's actually not accurate to the way writing even gets published, let alone.
Oh, wow.
So those are the things I'd mostly tell my students. Does that comport with what you guys see up there?
Yeah, that's beautiful, actually. The one thing I always just try to say is that, you know, there's a kind of a growing idea. It's been growing over the last 10 or 15 years that if you want to be a writer, you have to have an MFA. And if you have an MFA, you'll absolutely be a writer. And those two things I think are worth kicking in the butt a little bit because they're just not true. And it creates a kind of anxiety, especially in young people. And, you know, I always say, like, I got into Syracuse in this 1 year, but I wouldn't have gotten in the previous year. And I actually wouldn't have gotten in my second year of Syracuse. My writing really went downhill. So it kind of breaks my heart when somebody at, you know, 21 or 22 will apply, get rejected, and then quit because there's so much potential growth, you know. So I think in a way that I would like to see a lightening up of the MFA expectation a little bit. It's become a little bit tyrannical, I think.
Yeah, if I can say this in a way that is has every possible piece of due respect that I can give you, but to actually just kind of observe. I mean, so I came to Syracuse in 2004, and you and I had met because you'd published the Red Bow in Esquire magazine, but at the time you were a very well-known short story writer, but you'd never had a story in Best American Short Stories. You'd never been a finalist for a huge national award, right? And even at that moment where, I mean, I think you were deified by writers like me, it was gonna take a long time before those chips were gonna fall. And certainly at that moment, sort of on the other side. But part of what I'm saying is, like, I think those of us came to study you, it wasn't as if it was like, oh, like if we follow George's path, then like, then every single possible good thing that could happen will happen. And I think there's a danger in like the whole, there's a danger on all sides of the machine of making it seem as if, okay, you go get your Pulitzer after you pay your dues.
Yeah. 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 And you know, that's right. And I think one of the things that I've tried to emphasize at Syracuse is that there's zero correlation between being a lovely, important human being and publishing. You know, there's almost like there's two circles. There's a circle of your truth, you know, the stuff that you've earned and learned in your life and paid for with blood. And then the stuff that will write well. And for some people, those circles intersect, but other people, they don't, but it doesn't invalidate the circle, you know? And I think that's an important job because the idea that publication is the be all and end all is really, you know, kind of absurd. And and if you don't publish or you don't publish well, it doesn't invalidate the beautiful activity that you've engaged in to get there, you know?
Absolutely. Well, a wonderful human named Tony Rosato has been waiting for a long time to ask an awesome question, which is, there's so many short story masters, Hemingway, Monroe, on and on. Would love to know why you focus on these Russian artists in particular. Is there something about the time period? Is there something about their approach to the short story? What is it that makes you focus on them?
Yeah. I mean, the simple answer is that I, you know, I blundered into teaching the Russians back when Syracuse first hired me. They hired me when I was working as a tech writer, and I was going to come in that fall and have to teach a room full of grad students, some literary class, which was terrifying. And I'd been reading War and Peace and some of the other Russians. And I thought, well, if I teach the Russian short story, a few of which I knew at that point, then it'll give me an excuse to read them, you know? So that was how it started. And then really though, this book is made up of stories that I know for a fact teach well. You know, these are the stories that in a 14-week class, these would be the all-star team. These would be the days when the class would really come alive. So I don't, like I say in the book, I'm not sure they're the best Russian stories. They're not necessarily my favorites, but they're the ones that really are workhorses when it comes to talking about basic fictive principles and also stirring up the shit a little bit. You know, people really will disagree about these stories, which, as I said, is a great thing. You know, to have a 20 brilliant kids disagreeing over Gogol is like, you can just sit back and laugh, you know, it's great.
And bring out all the possibility, right? Well, with that in mind, actually, a former student of mine named Hillary Leicher, who is currently a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, did an awesome book called Temporary.
Oh, wow.
This year asks, I love what you said about masterpieces being hard to teach. Is there a story that you've taught that was a particularly difficult one to teach, but worth the challenge?
Yeah, I mean, the one I love to teach, and it was a little too much for this book, was Lady with Pet Dog, that Chekhov story. That really teaches nicely. Partly because people do resist it, I think. I resisted it when I was younger. I didn't see what the fuss was about. But it opens up, and it's in some ways, it's kind of a archetypal short story, because it starts off with this guy, Gurov, who's a kind of a serial cheater, you know, and he's at Yalta, and he's looking to pick up this young girl. And you get the sense that he's done this a lot of times, and he loves it, and it doesn't cost him anything. So because it's a story, you know that this is going to be the story of the time when that changes for him, theoretically. So the whole story becomes about, is it love yet? You know, you keep watching this guy to see when he's going to be transformed, which is another way of saying you're watching Chekhov to see what Chekhov defines as love, you know? So it's just a masterpiece of escalation and some really sophisticated twin scenes talking back and forth across the book. You almost can't believe how organized it is, but it's a little tough to teach because a lot of people have a reaction against it at first, and that takes a lot of class. The other one that's magnificent to teach is there's one by Tolstoy called The Devil, and somebody told me the other day it was actually found when he died, it was found sewed into his chair, the back of his chair, because it was so red hot that he didn't want it published while he was alive. And it's about, you know, this older Russian guy who cheats on his wife with his peasants, and it's got two endings that are written right into the story. And so it's a great chance to talk about endings and to talk about the endings that he didn't think of and so on. So that's a pretty good one too.
So there's actually a really wonderful question that I think will take us back to where you were pushing us, which is just, can you just circle back and start to say, where did you set out to write this book? And you know, I think after the huge successes of Lincoln and the Bardo, I mean, I was thinking about the fact that there was this, what I always thought was kind of overbearing critical voice that said, like, George, you must write a novel. And then you wrote the novel, and then you wrote 400 pages about short stories. So what was the impetus to get this down?
It was, I mean, partly it was just that, you know, that reduced teaching load and kind of feeling like, oh yeah, I'll probably never teach this class again. And I felt in a way, this is maybe being a little, taking it too far, but I felt a bit like I was a repository of all that, you know, those different classes of Syracuse students. We built up this kind of body of knowledge. So I thought it'd be kind of good to you know, get that down while I remembered it. And then a secondary thing was that I really felt like taking a breath, you know, at 60, whatever years old, and saying, what do I want to do with these, you know, these remaining years, the remaining 80 years of my life? I felt intuitively that if I just went back to the ground spring, or whatever you call it, you know, the fountain, that I would kind of get back in connection with the form. And I really wanted to do that. And it worked. I, you know, before the last time I taught this class, I was getting ready to go on the road for Lincoln, was spending a lot of time on the computer and my phone and stuff. And when I read these stories back there 5 or 6 years ago, they kind of had glossed over a little bit. They weren't doing that kind of sensual synesthesia thing that they do. they weren't speaking to me as much. And I got a little scared about that. So I thought if I just took a couple of years and dive back into them, it would reset my love for fiction. And it really did. I mean, I've never been so enthusiastic about the story form. So there was something about that. I just wanted to make sure that I didn't, you know, the years go by so fast and you can waste them so easily in projects that seem, you know, that maybe are just trivial somehow, or activities that are trivial. So I thought if I went back to these guys, it would focus me a little bit. And I think that's maybe happening, you know?
Yeah, I'll say I had my first ever year leave a couple of years ago, and you might not be able to see, but I went and found all the Constance Garnetts. It took me like a year to find all of them, but going back and reading Chekhov, I was actually in a period where people didn't really read the Constance Garnett because it was viewed as being kind of like a little wooden. And it felt really different going back to read them. I think I actually got a lot that I didn't get before. And actually, there's a couple of folks in the chat who have asked questions about how you thought about translations and how you thought about like acquiring potentially a little bit of Russian. And I'm interested just to know like how much of that kind of groundwork were you doing just to think about the different ways that they've been translated?
Yeah. What I did was I just said, these aren't really stories about the Russian versions. They're stories about the English versions, and I'm going to use the ones that I've used all along, somewhat out of just habit. You know, there's like this version of Gogol. I've been teaching that one since I first started teaching him. So I'm kind of in love with that version, even if I found out it was flawed, you know. And the thing is, you know, to go back to the earlier question, if somebody sent me the nose and I'd never read it before and they sent it in that English version, it would be a masterpiece. So, in a sense, I kind of just dodged the whole question of translation. I talk about it a little bit, but usually in class, what I would do is I'd only go to alternate translations if we weren't sure what was going on, you know, if we didn't really know what a story meant, then we'd go out to a couple alternate translations. We, you know, I had a really funny thing happen. I talk about it in the book, but there's a wonderful woman named Erica Haber at Syracuse. And the first or second time I taught this class, I had her come in to talk about this issue of translation. And she brought in this beautiful, comparison of like 9 different translations of A Part in the Overcoat. And she talks us through how every single one of them was inadequate and missed the humor. And, you know, and it almost kind of destroyed the semester because we were like, what are we reading exactly? You know, but I think for our purposes, for the writer's purposes, we can kind of say, well, even if it's only half as good as the Russian, it's still pretty good in English. Let's use that to talk about the fundamental principles, you know.
I will say jealously, and I'm just going to ask this question, even though I know there's a lot here, and I'll get to you guys. I was a little surprised that the Overcoat wasn't. I feel like I had heard you talk about how influential the Overcoat was on you, and I've thought a lot about, and this might be too literarily nerdy, but you know, Dostoevsky's first novella, Porfolk, was about this guy who had read The Overcoat and thought that it was too flat. And so when Dostoevsky said, we all came out from under Gogol's Overcoat, what he actually meant was like, let's get out from under Gogol's Overcoat. But I was curious about why it wasn't the Gogol you picked.
Well, you know what I did was I wrote essays about The Overcoat, Lady with the Pet Dog, Death of Ivan Illich, and 2 Isaac Babel stories, kind of got to about the third draft stage. And then I just basically scanned them to see which one had the most teaching points in it. And the somehow the nose won. I'm not sure. I love The Overcoat. It's maybe my favorite story. But I think in some ways, I kind of felt inclined not to write about my favorite stories, because I didn't want it to really to be worshipful, but I wanted it was for me a teaching document from the beginning. So maybe a second volume.
Another swim in another pond.
Not. yeah, swim in a different pond in a different.
A wonderful man named Joseph Quinn has been wanting forever to ask, and I think this really fits in. Does anyone know anything about Gogol's process, if there's revisions to the nose or the Overcoat or Diary of a Madman? Do we know anything about it?
I don't know a single thing about it. I don't. Yeah, I don't. I, you know, it's funny. I didn't really, I think he must have written pretty quickly, because his whole career, I think, spans about 10 years, you know, and it's got one of the greatest plays ever written, The Government Inspector, maybe the greatest novel, Dead Souls, and 2 of the greatest short stories, The Nose and The Overcoat. So I get a feeling that he wasn't following my fussy method. He was doing something entirely different. And then when he went off, you know, when he fell out of his groove, It was, I think, more of a psychological problem than any, you know, he repented of his smart ass qualities and got a little religious, you know. So I have a feeling he was maybe just one of those people we hate, those people who can sit down and write pretty brilliantly, you know, early.
It was the 1830s and 1840s, so one would assume that it was painstakingly handwritten in a way that maybe would have taken a different kind of just physical labor to get that work done. On that same line, yeah. And as you brought it up before, there's these famous stories of Isaac Bobble that his wife said that he would, if he had to finish writing a story, he'd put it down and he'd pick up his keys and he'd get his coat and he'd leave and then he'd run back into the room to get down what he like thought he wouldn't be able to catch if he didn't do it that way. And I actually, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember you telling me back in the day when I was there that in some ways those sort of those Bobble stories, the late Bobble stories, were a huge influence on you guys when you were at Syracuse. And I know
there's
some of the writers who, like, I know I deify, and I think you do too, from Grace Paley to Amy Hempel to Lenny Michaels, like, are just such clear antecedents. There's just such a clear lineage from Bobble to them. So I am curious, beyond, I know you say in the book it's because he was in the 20th century, but yeah, what did go into thinking of his not being in there?
Yeah, I would have made an exception if I needed to, you know, to get him in there. When I got to the stories I love of his to teach are In the Basement, which is maybe the best story ever on class. De Maupassant is another really beautiful one. My First Dove Coat is good. And in some, anything from Red Cavalry, but somehow, you know, this book as a sort of teaching document had a certain narrative going on. And when you get to Bobble, it takes a turn. And somehow when I put those essays in there, they really were jarring somehow. They didn't quite, build on the previous stuff. So I thought it was, best to kind of keep the focus a little tight, but he's an amazing writer. And, those stories are magnificent.
If I begged really hard right now, would you just publish them as essays?
I'd send them to you, but I wouldn't publish them because they're all about, all of those are about, you know, if the whole thing was a 10 in terms of rewriting, they're at about the 3 stage, and I left them there at that point, you know, so.
Okay, yeah. I'll stop. So a wonderful man named Gregory Brandt says, "Hey, George, thanks for being here." And he thanks me too. So he's my favorite person of the night. He says, "When you're teaching, how do you know when to speak? And how do you know when to remain quiet?"
Well, that's a good question. And the biggest lesson I've learned over my teaching career is to just shut up when possible. If you can shut up, you know, be quiet. Because our students especially are so amazing that if you just kind of give them, you know, that look, they will get to the answer, you know, quickly. So these days I really believe in a kind of judo, like, you know, you let somebody talk themselves out. And you know, the other thing I've noticed is in workshop, especially, it used to be, you know, when I was younger, I was really insecure about my background. And the main thing was I wanted to show that I knew what I was talking about and I wanted to provide value, you know? So I'd write just pages and pages of notes and go over and over it. And, I think it could be a little overwhelming, I suspect, you know, for somebody to hear all these ideas. So now what I'm really trying to do is rein myself in and kind of wait for the student to ask, you know, like there's nothing more powerful than if a student says, I'm stuck on page 8, or I don't know how to do an ending. The perfect class is when I've done all that work off the page and I kind of know what I'd like to tell her. There's 3 points I want to tell her, but I don't tell her until she asks, you know. Then it's like a, you know, in a medical analogy, you know, when someone says I'm sick and you offer the medicine, they're going to pay more attention to the instructions, you know? So for me, the big thing is to over the years to try to build the confidence to hold back, just as you're implying. And that's, you know, that's, it's hard. It's hard because insecurity is working against you. I anyway want to feel like I'm giving something, giving. And sometimes that overrides your ability to hear what they're actually saying.
Yeah, if it won't embarrass you for me to say it, certainly my first 2 or 3 years teaching here at Bryn Mawr, I just have in the back, like, a thing would happen and then I would think, what would George say? And then I'd just start babbling, and it definitely has helped.
Yeah.
I actually heard—
That's what I would do. That's what I would generally do, is just babble. That's correct.
I heard the biographer Robert Caro actually in the interview recently say, somebody asked him his interview technique, and he just said every question was just what you just said. He would, I mean, it's, he's so prolific, it's hard to imagine, but that every interview just starts with as much silence as he can tolerate, just to get that story out there. Gerard Alexander asks, and this is a really interesting one in terms of thinking about the book as a whole, what overarching structural components or techniques did you find common to all of the seven stories? And did you discover anything new while you were developing the essays?
I think I found what I tried to develop was a model for reading that would fit all of these stories. And the basic model I found is, and the one I use in my own work, is that one, it's the conversation is the perfect model. You know, the reader and the writer sit across a table from each other. To the extent that that's a genuine, intimate conversation, it's going to be mutually interesting. To the extent that it's the writer doing a data dump on his poor victim, the reader, it's going to feel like condescension, and the reader's going to pull out of it. So that was one thing, was just the idea that when in doubt, check yourself. Am I treating my reader like a you or a thou, basically, you know? And it's true even of sarcastic stories or wild, edgy stories. You always have a friend on the other end, and if you think she's really smart and curious and worldly, you're going to talk to her differently than if you think she's someone to be preached to. The second thing that I found in the stories was just the idea that so much of what we do in the story is dictated by the form. The form says escalate. You know, the form says be efficient. The form says don't waste. The form says transcend. You know, almost every one of these stories starts in a certain place at stasis. And by the end of the story, it's grown out of that, and transcendence has happened. So I think there are certain principles that are almost, it's not like there are rules, but there are laws, in the same way that in physics there are laws. Gravity, you know, there's a law of gravity which says, well, like it or not, gravity exists. So in this story form, you know, forward propulsion, brevity, efficiency are laws, in the same way that for a dancer, gravity is a law. A dancer who says gravity doesn't exist is not actually doing her job, you know. So this is my view. Now, there are writers who think differently about it, but I would say even in the most esoteric language-driven story, the reader brings an expectation of escalation and of efficiency. Sometimes the writer is having fun by thwarting that, like Waiting for Godot, or some of David Foster Wallace's pieces, which are, you know, defiantly, joyfully anti-efficiency. But there are certain forces in the fictive universe that we don't get to opt out of, it, I guess would be my thing. So in each of these stories, I'm kind of explaining how those laws are honored by the writer.
Yeah, I can't remember if you took this up or not, but I was thinking about it a bunch, actually, in Master and Man, which is a story that I love. And I think I've always had a similar, I get stuck a little on that one transition where it becomes so didactic. But there's a moment early on in that story, and this is going to get too nerdy for one second, but I'm not going to leave without asking it, where they go to this town and they have their horse. And you know that they're potentially going to be in danger. And the first person they meet is the best horse thief in the town. And there's a part of me that every time I read that story, I can't not be like waiting for him to come out in the snow and steal the horse. And I mean, I wonder, like, how much did you at times get stuck in like a Tolstoy moment or a Turgenev moment like that, where it wasn't just that you weren't picking up the laws out of it, but it was like, I think this is defying some like pretty basic storytelling laws in a way that if I focused on it would actually seem like a flaw, but it's just part of the story.
Yeah, my sense of that is that I'm not sure. I hear what you're saying. I think that is a bit of a feint, because they should stop in that town, and I think that Vasily flinches a little bit because of the presence of that horse thief. He thinks if they stay, their horse will go missing, which totally plays to his character. He's protective of all his property, but it's a funny thing because you shouldn't really need that, you know. But I think it's a little bit of a, you know, it's funny because with this thinking about efficiency. I think in furniture making, there's something called, I want to say wabi-sabi. I may have that totally wrong, but the idea is you design in a defect. so that it'll feel like it was made by a human being. So I think in some of these stories, in the face of all this crushing efficiency, they'll put in a little, just a little something to make you, to remind you that this is supposed to be real life and not everything is mathematical, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, that guy should show up in the second visit, but he doesn't.
Weirdly, he shows up in a Chekhov story called The Horse Thieves, but we'll talk about that at a different time. This might be too hard to answer, but there's a question here. I'd love to hear what you'd have to say from a wonderful person named John Starlipper that says, if you were writing an American version of your book, what stories might you include?
Oh, that's a great question. I was thinking about this. I would include the first one I would put in there was a story called The Stone Boy by Gina Berryalt, who's a beautiful, underappreciated writer. I would put in The Gilded Six Bit, I think, by Zora Neale Hurston, which teaches really beautifully. I put in something by Grace Paley. I think I'd put in something by Hemingway, maybe Cat in the Rain, maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure. I might put in a Rebecca Curtis story. I think that she's got some really killer things that are. I'd put in The Finkelstein Five by Nana. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there are some that really teach. There's that one, anything by Richard Yates teaches really beautifully, I think. Yeah, that's an interesting question. But you know, it's funny. I always found that I do teach a version of this class with American writers, and somehow I never have as much fun with it as with the Russians. And I don't exactly know why. Maybe I like the fact that the Russian material is a little bit old, you know, and a little bit dusty and a little bit unfamiliar. And the Americans, it seems like American stuff gets brought into it faster and it's easier for it to get off into the political or the cultural, whereas the Russian stuff, they're almost like fairy tales in a certain way.
Yeah. 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 Becky Curtis's work has been just on fire lately. I can't wait till everybody.
Yeah, she's amazing.
All of those between covers. She's also very funny, and a wonderful person named Nicholas Benai says, "Hey George, thanks for being here. Do you think humor is an intuitive thing, or are there guidelines or thoughts that you have about how to make humor work well?"
I think it's pretty much an intuitive thing. I really do. I think it's, for me, it was something that I just almost dysfunctionally reverted to in any social situation that was tense or sad or weird. I just would just be reflexively obnoxiously funny. Or try to be funny, about a 30% hit rate. But I think for me, the big moment was when it felt natural to start doing that in fiction. When I allowed myself to start doing it, that's when it became. So I don't think there's any, you know, I was talking to Toby Wolf the other night and he reminded me of something that our mutual friend Michael Hare said to the question of should writing be political, or, you know, how should it be? And Michael said something like, he said it better, but basically should is the enemy of the artist. And I would add that must is also a big thing. So I see a lot of people who want to be funny, but there's no imperative to be funny if you aren't naturally, you know, or to be funny in a mode other than you're funny. So one of the things I say in the book is that we are kind of trying to get our personal attributes to line up with our fictional style. You know, if you're funny, it would be kind of weird if humor didn't show up, but unfortunately it's not a one-to-one correspondence. But I can give you an example, Dan, that involves you. When you were a student, there was one story you brought in. I don't remember the name of it or even what it was about, but I remember the moment, which was suddenly the language that you were using kind of just became just beautifully expressive, like really bold. And I think before that, I felt that you had a bit of a minimalist tendency, but some switch got thrown, and it was the same kind of language that I see in your books now. For a teacher, that is the most thrilling thing, because nobody asked you to do it, told you to do it. I think maybe under the pressure of the program, you were impelled to do that. But that was the case where suddenly the guy that I knew day to day, who was very culturally savvy and really bright and really funny and articulate, that person was present in the work instantly, you know. So that's another mode of advancement that we can do, which is not the incremental line by line stuff that the workshop approach implies, but this kind of throwing off of a false costume that can happen. And I think it can sometimes happen under the pressure of the MFA program, because you're surrounded by these talented people and your ego is trying so hard to say, well, what's unique about me? And in that moment of duress, sometimes the costume costume flies off, you know. So that's the same with humor. You know, if you resort to humor in your real life, it probably should find a way in your work. But should and the must are to be.
If I can speak out of the classroom, I'll say, you know, and I'll try to say it without crying. But, you know, I mean, I remember being in your office probably that first year. And I remember at one point, and I get now that you like were waiting for that moment. And maybe it was after that story. But I remember you saying, listen, like a lot of the time you just seem like you're trying to prove to people that, you know, calculus or that you've done all your homework. You were like, but you have a natural entertainer in you. And you should just allow yourself to do that. And it definitely feels like it was such a huge moment of just like imprimatur for me, but also now that I'm a teacher, recognizing, obviously you didn't say that, that wasn't the right thing to say to everybody in that situation, but you were listening to me and just being listened to in that way. It was both that you were right and also just to have been listened to that closely, it just changes things for you as an artist, you know?
Yeah, and that's something, I'm glad that happened. And I'm glad for the readers of the world that happened. But one of the things that I've noticed lately is that's the golden ticket. If you can find an instance of somebody being themselves and just bless it, that's huge, you know, because they already know how to do that. They don't need fine tuning on that. And the most horrible thing would be if somebody in workshop did that and nobody noticed it, you know, or nobody had the sort of courage to say, you really nailed it. You know, I think, you know, I think back to when I came to Syracuse, you really do want somebody to see you, you know, and part of that I benefited from was that there wasn't any falseness about how they saw me. Like I was doing pretty mediocre work at Syracuse and I wasn't being hyperbolically praised for it, which was a total blessing, you know, because then your ego goes, hey, they're not praising me. And it comes up with the plan B, you know, which is good.
Totally. So as we're getting down to time, there's sort of two areas of questions that are maybe a little outside of what we've been talking about that I do want to get in. And I'll ask the tougher one first. And I apologize to you guys in the audience if I'm not doing a good job of distilling this. But we are at a moment where politics are complicated. And we are in a moment where I think folks like, maybe I'll say it this way. I know for me, I'm a lot more vocal about my politics and a lot more clear about my politics than I ever have been. And certainly in some of the ways that you talk about class or in taking on some of those that big New Yorker piece at the election, you know, it finds its way in a more overt way. And how do you think about, you're so good at, and this is me distilling a number of these questions, but you're so good at reaching out and showing that empathy, but what kinds of stumbling blocks or walls does that empathy hit when potentially we're at a point where people can't hear a kind of tone or are unwilling to?
Well, I'm learning about these words, empathy, sympathy, compassion, love. They don't mean the same thing. So for me, I for many years, I thought empathy, compassion, love means I understand you and I love you and I'm going to listen to you and I'm going to, you know, I think it does. But that also comes to an end, you know. If your kid was going to put her finger in a light socket, it would not be empathetic at all to let her, you know. So I think, you know, there's a place for firmness and for pushback. But the way I understand it in an effective way is this. And it's personal. I mean, everyone has their own limitations and proclivities and bandwidth. But for me, I have loved the idea since I was a young Catholic wonk that Jesus is like the ultimate novelist. That Jesus can walk up to any person, no matter how despicable, and look at that person and love them, meaning pay attention to the ultimate degree. It doesn't mean condone. It doesn't mean enable. It means see through, maybe do a passable version of that person's inner monologue. That to me is a superpower, especially if you're political, because in that mode, you could really understand the dynamics of your enemy, you know, which to me seems very powerful. But here's my thing. I said this earlier today. I said, you know, the short story form may not be ideal for expressing political belief. It may just not be. And so therefore I try to have a political life and an artistic life. But then I went upstairs today and wrote a very political story, you know? So I think the beauty of the form is that you don't really have to decide in advance. You don't really have to have a position. The position reasserts itself every time you sit down And I think you have to kind of trust that your subconscious will take care of you in that way. But I think certainly to be, this is not a time for mushiness among decent people. It's a time for firmness and strength. To me, that includes compassion and understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really beautifully put. And I think part of what I hear when I listen to you talk about it, especially like that answer you just gave, is that it really matters that we're asking the right questions when we're asking that question, right? And that we're not taking for granted what the terms are. There's a really wonderful essay in Harper's this year by the novelist Garth Greenwell called Against Relevance. And it was just an argument about the material of that. Like, it wasn't about politics. It was just that for what's in the stories or the novel to need to be quote unquote relevant or topical is actually sometimes where we get ourselves into eddies. And I know for me, you know, my last book, which I'm now still kind of working on because I'm working on a screenplay as it's going towards production. So I've been thinking about it for way too long. It was meant to be topical when I finished it in 2016 and changed immensely when Trump came into office. But I was talking to Jonathan Franzen a little bit right before it came out and was asking him about how he handles it. And he said, you know, just at the last moment, I sort of just tune up whatever those things are that feel like they have to be timely and then just hope for the best. And it did, like, there's a deepness. There's a depth that like made me think, oh, right. So like the foundation doesn't require that. Sometimes the service does, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The other thing I think for me, it's important to remember that when you're talking about politics or moral ethical stuff, or it's also contained in the form, you know, like if you, when you read a piece of writing that's really reacting to itself in a sophisticated, intelligent way, that's political no matter what. It's political because it celebrates human intelligence. You know, it says the human mind is capable of this kind of highly organized, highly self-reflective scheme. And that's beautiful, you know. Or the other thing is that, you know, there's that great Chekhov story called Grief, you know, where the guy, he's a cabbie, a horse-drawn cabbie, and his son has died that day, and he still has to work. And all he's trying to do is tell somebody about this. He's just desperate to share his grief, and nobody will listen to him because he's so low on the totem pole, you know. And he gets pushed, and he gets sworn at and stuff. And finally, in the end of this little tiny story, he goes into the stable, and he just puts his head against his horse's head, and he says, "I had a son," you know. Now, to me, there's nothing more political than that, because it just says this little human being that you might have overlooked is every bit as real as you are, which should be the basis of every politics, I would say, if you can, you know, if we have the bandwidth for it.
Yeah. Okay, this is going to be a transition question. It's going to be way too heavy, but I'm still just going to ask it. I've thought virtually every day since reading it about the last paragraph of your New Yorker Trump rallies piece, where you say, and I'm just going to paraphrase you badly, but you essentially said, "Never truly thought about America as an experiment, or never truly imagined that it could fail." And I do kind of want to just ask you directly, for me, and I hope for the audience, like when you see what was happening on January 6th, 4 years later, like where do you land on what you were thinking 4 years earlier in that paragraph?
I think the experiment is under extreme duress in every direction, you know, from the right. But the biggest challenge that we have is, can we finally do what we've always said we were going to do? You know, can we really be a place where every human being is valued equally? And that's it's not a musty old thing. It's still in progress. On Martin Luther King Day, we can, you know, I drove across the country a couple of years ago, and I listened to Dr. King speeches on the way in my little Prius, you know, and it was crazy. They're so beautiful, and they could have been spoken yesterday, you know, and yet you look up and all this time has passed. So I think it's a beautiful, urgent moment for us, because there's no reason we couldn't make a country that we're all proud of. Really, I mean, really, that we really loved, because it was our labor of love. The only mission that's high enough for that is the original one, which is to say, we're actually going to transcend all this bullshit. We're going to transcend racism and sexism and all that. We're going to do it with, now here it gets a little tricky, because to me, it's basically a spiritual thing. You know, if in any spiritual tradition, including humanism, if you follow it far enough up the chain, it says that we, to put it in Buddhist terms, we all have Buddha nature. So that's the part you're supposed to concentrate on in another person. That could be a beautiful experiment, but I think it's under so much, it's put it this way. It's so much more in danger than I could have imagined that day. You know, that day was nothing. Back there in 2016, it was kind of all funny games. And now I don't know what's going on. And it's, you know, these really are times to try men's souls. And this is really the moment when we have to say deep within ourselves, could I love a version of this country? If so, now is the time that the fight really begins. You know, that is heavy. That's really heavy.
Yeah. So we'll get later. But no, I will say, you know, I'm paying way too much attention to this stuff. And I think just as like a Jewish Holocaust survivor, it's always just kind of like, I feel like I'm the emotional canary in every coal mine. But, you know, there was a big Washington Post piece that came out today where that showed that in the week since Trump's been off Twitter, that there's been 70% less misinformation passed around on social media. I mean, I think there are certainly scenarios in which the experiment finds its footing again, actually kind of quickly. And we just need to
for sure.
Experience right now. Okay, so that does transition to the other just like kind of big question that people have been asking. And I think we could talk about it as capaciously as you'd like. But lots of people kind of want to know, for you, what's it like to move between fiction and nonfiction? So we were talking about that Trump piece, but also, you know, the whole Braindead Megaphone book. I was up in Syracuse while you were working on the Wall piece and on the Buddha Boy piece. And what's it like switching back and forth between the two, and how have they informed each other?
Fiction is really the great love of my life. The nonfiction helps me to get more of the real world into what I'm doing. That, you know, to take those trips and to go to the Trump rallies and all that. It just, you know, the danger as you get older is that you solidify around your concepts. You know, you have some ideas that you have had and been praised for, and then those become like these big, you know, redwood poles in your heart. Then you stop looking, you stop wondering. So to go on those trips, I always have this, you know, incredible trajectory where, you know, you're insecure because somebody just gave you a bunch of money to write a story. So you write it in your head before you go, and you got all your liberal pieties lined up nicely. And then you go, and then the world destroys everything. You know, if you're doing your job, the world destroys everything. And then you come off the job the last day and you got nothing. You know, that's the sacred moment when you really got nothing. So I kind of do those jobs mostly to do that, just to refresh my kind of sense of humility about what I know and what I don't know. And then when I go back to fiction, I find that the ground has kind of been cleared and a lot of the old habits are gone because they don't fit the new data. You know, I think I'm a much better fiction writer. I'm a more happy fiction writer, but it's good to expand oneself, you know, through that, I guess.
I love when you do it, so I hope you'll keep doing it. Okay, the other question that we were just going to land on, because it's been asked a bunch of times here, is just if you had some Rilke-like advice for the young writer, what advice would you offer them?
I think the biggest one is you learn to rewrite, really. That's kind of an old cliche, but to be comfortable doing what I would call radical revision, to move things around and to cut stuff and to, you know, always consider everything negotiable until the very last minute. That's a big skill. And the reason is because it lets more of you into the work. It gives you more chances to make those micro choices that are going to infuse you into your work. If you can learn to do that. That's really the biggest one. The other thing I think is to, you know, I get hear from a lot of young writers, which I love. And often they lead with, and I would have done this at the same age, they lead with a list of their terrible problems that prohibit them from being a writer. In other words, they lead with imposter syndrome. You know, here's what's wrong with me. And they always say it as if they're the only one with that problem. But what I try to tell my students is that whatever your obstruction is, that's actually a gift. You know, when you get to a place in a story where you're stymied, that means the story is thinking and it's going to go deeper if you wait. If you're somebody who obsesses over should I do A or B, that very decision is going to be the topic of your work, you know? So in a way, I kind of counsel my students to do what I call self-gaming, which is to say, think about, there's no answers to fiction. There's no textbook. There's no list of commandments. So try to think about it in a way that makes you happy and makes you productive. You know, you're going to be making up rules all the time. You're going to make up ways of approaching things. There's no reason it has to be a totally neurotic, painful thing, especially if you see it as craft is just that which allows you to bring yourself, your true self, to the table. And you might not know what that true self consists of exactly, you know. So my approach lately is to try to, you know, tune down the torture a little bit and kind of say that if a person is managed to be charming in real life, there might be a corollary in fiction, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, maybe the biggest thing is that I think work, you know, if you work your way, that tells you what your obstructions are, you work, and that tells you how to cure them. So I think the hours is really a big thing too.
Well, I remember hearing you give a version of that answer at times when we were up in Syracuse together. And I remember at times being frustrated that it couldn't become fun the way that I wanted it to, but I know it finally now has. I mean, I remember actually you said,
yeah,
you were just like, you know, it's all the game and you need to just have fun playing the game. And I'm not sure if it's just time or if it's getting some of that validation under your belt, but I know for me, even if people don't love it, I'm having so much more fun when I'm working now than ever before. And I'm deeply grateful to you for the gift of just keeping my eyes peeled for one.
But it might also be that we have to kind of, you know, mess around with our definition of fun. You know, like if you're on a long road trip and the car breaks down and you're walking through the mud, it's kind of fun. You know, if you perceive it as an adventure that, you know, then it might be fun.
It's also the man who's been inside a house for one full year. So, you know, that changes the thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, George, so much for all this generosity and time. And thank you, audience, for your questions.
Dan, thank you. It's been such a pleasure. Loved being here with you. Love to your family.
And to yours, George. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.